Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospel according to St. Matthew, and today we're going to continue in the 22nd chapter, verses 34 to 40. This chapter follows a very interesting passage, and it's a radical kind of a change of tone of what goes on. For Jesus had just had, as this passage opens, Jesus has just had a discussion with the Sadducees, who do not believe in the resurrection of the dead. And he has, in a way, confounded them because he says that God is identified as the God of Israel, as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, as he identifies himself to Moses. So that then Jesus' question to the Sadducees is, if God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they are not alive, then you're talking about simply a God of the dead. And the Pharisees are confounded by this because this certainly is contrary to the whole, even in the Pharisees' point of view, contrary to the whole ethos of the Old Testament, in which God is a living God, a God who dwells and accompanies his people through history. So that in this idea then that God is alive, and that if Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive, so that he is the God of the living, then they must have been raised from the dead, because they have been dead for a very long time by the time that Jesus is teaching among his own people. So this is why this gospel starts out with, when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they got together to disconcert him, and one of them put a question. Now notice what's happening here is that the Pharisees are, of course, jubilant that he has silenced the Sadducees, and there's great competition between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So where the Sadducees failed to confound Jesus, now the Pharisees themselves are going to take up the quest and see if they can't. And the reason that this is so problematic, because, Master, which is the greatest commandment of the law? Well, what they're dealing with is the rabbinical discussions of the first century. And in these rabbinical discussions of the first century, what they're doing is they have begun to analyze the law in questions of important and less important, small and great commandments and so forth. There are 613 distinct commandments. 248 of them are positive, the do's, the things you must do, and 365 negative, the things that you don't do, that you mustn't do. So they are busy in their discussions and their conversations with each other of sorting through these things and trying to prioritize them. And obviously one group of Pharisees will prioritize one way, another group will prioritize another way, and so forth. So they think now what they're going to do is they're going to get Jesus to identify with a faction. This is always what they're trying to do to Jesus. They're always trying to get him to identify with a faction. And when they identify with a faction, then they simply can marginalize him, pull him out of the major discussions, and just say, oh, well, he's part of this faction, and that's what they all say anyway. And so be dismissive of him. But Jesus doesn't do that. He answers them. And he answers them, and he said, Jesus says, you must love the greatest commandment. You must love the Lord your God with your whole heart, with your whole soul, with your whole mind. This is the greatest and the first commandment. The second resembles it. You must love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang the whole law and the prophets also. In other words, what he's saying to them, think about it and realize that somehow or other these smaller questions that you are asked asking all fall under the heading of the two great commandments, the love of God and the love of neighbor. He quotes this, and he does so with the what is called the beginning of the Shema, the blessing. There's arguments whether this part of the blessing from Leviticus actually was incorporated into the writings of the first century, but nevertheless, the idea certainly is embedded in the great prayer of Israel. And so what he's doing then is he's saying something, and in Mark's gospel, this is a benevolent question, because in Mark's gospel, he says truly, he sees goodness in the person who asks him the question, and he sees authenticity and honesty in his intent to find out. And he says to him, therefore, you know, you are near to the kingdom of heaven. Matthew's gospel just leaves it with the explanation, actually. And so we're not sure whether there are benevolent questioners involved or whether it's just part of the ongoing Sadducee-Pharisee battle that's going on. And where one failed to trip up Jesus, the other one was pretty sure they could do it because they would draw them into the rabbinical structure of the prioritization of all the laws that applied to the daily lives of the people of Israel. But for us here, what does this mean? And I think it's a very, very important thing, and a thing that so often we tend to obscure. The idea that the first and the most important commandment of all is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. It's almost a prerequisite for an authentic manifestation of the second part of the quote. The second part of the law, love your neighbor as yourself. We know that in Luke, this then asks a question about who is my neighbor, and that gives us the story of the Good Samaritan. But for us now, in our own modern experience of the faith, and in our own modern understanding of the practice of the faith, it becomes very problematic for us to realize the primary focus is on the living God, the Most High God. We are in an age where we are inundated with a certain idea, and this is interesting because this goes back into Marxist thought, that in Marxism they have done away with the whole idea of personal morality. The whole moral questions become public morality or ethical questions. This is one of the ways in which people try to slide out from underneath the idea of the personal God. And in that idea of the personal God, therefore, if God is personal, then we have as persons an obligation to have an interactive relationship with that God. But if we can remove God from the realm of the personal and simply put him in to the second commandment, which is the love of neighbor as yourself, then we can follow the modern trend of saying social justice, all of those and everything that entails is in fact the manifestation of the fulfillment of the great commandments. But that's only true if God is not a personal God. That is only true if God is not a person. Because actually, in the world of the New Testament, what happens is that the person who has the faith in God, who has the relationship with the Most High God, is the person then who understands God's love for us and is willing to share that then with others. And that the professionalization of religion is not necessarily the fulfillment of the great commandment. Again, in Luke's gospel, that's clear. The priest goes by, the Levite goes by, and then the accursed Samaritan comes by, and then he's the one who stops and who helps the neighbor. He stops and he helps the neighbor implicit because within himself he has a sense of the dignity of the human person. He can only get that in some kind of a faith relationship with the living God. So when we come to this then, the question then devolves upon us is not to go through and sort out the whole idea of social justice, the whole idea of material charity, the whole idea of international politics or national politics or any of those kinds of things. Those things are very often substitutes for faith, substitutes for the personal relationship with the living God, for an interactive relationship with the living God who is person, as we are person also. And so it is therefore too easy to do that. And we get caught up in that because of the modern culture and because of the tremendous impact that 19th century philosophy had on modern culture, and especially in the realm of the materiality of our culture, the tremendous impact of the philosophy of Karl Marx. That somehow or other, what Marx does is he creates a horizontal reality. Now, we can say, well, that's not exactly true because there's a Hegelian element to him, and he believes that, you know, in some ways a dialectic produces then something else that's better and so forth, which is the whole nature of Marx's revolution. But no, it still is in many ways a horizontal world and something that I think we can rightly and truly begin to call a flat earth. That somehow or other, the complications of the divine relationship with his God's own creation is just seems in some ways in the modern world to be oppressive to us. That if that's true, then that means that somehow or other we owe him something or how or other we are accountable to him. And how does he speak to us about our own accountability in the world? He speaks to us through the teachings of Jesus. He speaks to us in the commandments of the Old Testament. He teaches this in the moralistic stories of the Old Testament and so forth. He teaches us somehow that through him we come to understand the world we live in better. And understanding it better, we see the underlying benevolence of the good and creating God. In so doing that, then, we are drawn into a love of neighbor, which somehow or other is more authentic than that which is simply a horizontal, flat earth ethical mandate. I heard one time in talking about Mother Teresa that it seems in some ways it was hard not to admire Mother Teresa and not to understand that her force and her power came from beyond herself. And yet there were those, as we know, I think Christopher Hitchens certainly attacked her, a group of nuns in Chicago attacked her, and because she helped persons instead of overthrowing the Indian government or whatever they wanted her to do, I'm not sure, but it was some kind of outrageous political activity. They wanted her to be an activist rather than a Christian, and they were distressed by this. However, Mother Teresa knew very well that it was in her relationship with God that she even understood what a person was. And so that, and saw in that person the hand of the living God, the presence of the living God, and therefore strove to love her God by caring for the persons whom he loved. It seems for us a natural reaction, but for those who have bought the flat earth philosophy of life, it is, of course, an outrage. And they say instead, well, she was just altruistic, which is an ethical term. An ethical term meaning someone is a flat earth idealist. And in so doing, therefore, in their idealism, they are do-gooders. The very thing that St. Louise de Marillac warned her sisters, the Daughters of Charity, about in the 17th century in Paris. Don't be do-gooders. Love the people you help, and do so because of your love for God and his love for them. And it's a radically different approach. We see the flat earth altruism go on, for instance, in the United Nations, and the whole United Nations population control department, where they, being themselves primarily middle-class people, experiencing the conveniences and the comfort of wealth, are willing, therefore, to struggle to force the bourgeois lifestyle on all the peoples of the earth, even those for whom it is terribly offensive. You know, I recall in the 1960s, I was behind the Iron Curtain. I worked on a collective farm in Slovakia. And we were sitting around one evening talking after work, and some of the people were asking me, well, what about in the States, in the United States? What do you do? Like, and they were talking about health care, about false teeth, about glasses, about all that kind of stuff. And so at that time, I said, well, you know, we have to pay for those ourselves. And which at the time, in many ways, most of us in some way, shape, or form did have to do and still do have to do in many instances. And they were flabbergasted by that, and they thought, you know, I don't think I'd really like to live in that world. I would be frightened to live in that world when I didn't know, you know, how I was going to be able to take care of myself and so forth. Well, obviously, human freedom is a very important thing, and obviously, when the wall came down, the Orthodox Church sprang back to life in the Eastern Bloc. But there was that underlying fear of us trying to make them like us when they were afraid of that. They were insecure in that. They were not happy with that. And so that was a very interesting experience for me, a very interesting conversation for me. But when you go to Africa into the bush country or into the desert and so forth and try getting women to kill their babies because their life will be happier if they do, that is the grossest form of flat earth imperialism. It is altruism with an evil core and an evil heart. And it is destructive to humanity and destructive to the human race. There are ways to deal. There are humane ways to deal with human problems and human difficulties. But indoctrination and bullying doesn't happen to be one of them that is very much akin to the idea of love your neighbor as yourself. And that is exactly what so much of this population business is all about. It's what this country did for a long time, going around with the only foreign policy we seemed to have that was to force women to have abortions. It's a bizarre situation, but it makes sense only in a Marxist flat earth world where there is no dimensionality to human experience and no dimensionality to the reality of our lives. Without the first commandment, the second commandment is a flat commandment because it has no motivation. It has no rationale to it. It has no reason for it. The only reason for it is we see in so many modern movements is to impose my will on somebody else. Make other people live like I live because certainly they will be so much happier. And, well, we have to look around and see how happy are we as a society, as a world, filled with all sorts of emotional and mental problems, filled with all sorts of broken relationships and fragmented societies and all of this kind of thing. You know, is that really something that a harmonious society really, you're going to be so much better if you'd only fight with each other. You're going to be so much better if you turn on yourselves. You're going to be so much better if you hate everyone around you and so forth. It really is strange. It's incredibly strange. So when we, however, now go back to the gospel, and Jesus says you must love the Lord, the first and the greatest commandment. The first and the greatest. You must love the Lord your God with your whole heart, with your whole soul, with your whole mind. This is crucial and critical to the fulfillment of the second. You know, even in postmodern philosophy, there is this awareness, there is this understanding that the human person is somehow or other incomplete without having a loving relationship with another person or with the other. Authentic religion gives us access to the other. and invites us into this relationship with the other, which is a loving relationship, which gives them which gives us wisdom and understanding and care. And without that without that completion of myself as a person in the love of for the other and the other's love for me, I do not see into the heart of the human person. I do not see into the very soul of humanity. With that insight, I have a sense of it because I experience it myself within myself. I have a sense of it, and I can therefore nurture that reality inside of another person. I can nurture them through care, through kindness. Then this is where all of the social justice stuff and all of that kind of thing comes into play, not as an ideology and not as a flat earth policy, but as the personal dimensionality of human society, human beings, human interpersonal relationships, and so forth. Without the first, you don't have the second. And even we see many people saying, well, you know, I love another or another loves me. Is that why we have a 50% divorce rate? Is that why, you know, we have broken families? Is that why we have fragmented neighborhoods? Is that why we have all that? Because I really do love somebody? It's really hard to comprehend that argument, actually. And brought down to its most basic level, it makes no sense. And it is not authenticated by human experience. And I think that human experience, which flows from being loved and loving, has the capacity to unlock the mystery of truth in other persons, to see within them the pain and the suffering or the joy, all of the things that go on within the human heart. And these cold, hard, fake smiling bureaucrats who are the armies of flat earth altruism do not in any way enter into the human heart. They do not in any way nurture the inner life of the human being. They instead turn with anger on those who do so. For instance, the anger leveled against Mother Teresa for the work that she did with the poor. So when we get this then, what are we talking about for ourselves? How do we know God and how do we love God with our whole heart, our whole soul, our whole mind? How do we do that? We do that through our prayer, through our personal sacrifice, through the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, when the other becomes part of who we are and lifts us up to the Father. We do it through the willingness to give up for the sake of others, for the willingness to sacrifice for the sake of another. We do it in all the traditional ways, and not to be trite or hackneyed in any way, but certainly we are familiar with the spiritual and the corporal works of mercy, which have been at the very root and the heart of Catholicism for centuries and centuries and centuries. This idea of giving spiritual and material consolation to those in need, motivated by the fact that God loves them and us as well, so that we might love each other, and not motivated by saying, once I do this, I will have power over them. Once I do this, then I will be able to remold them into my own image and likeness, into the image and the likeness of the bourgeois world in which I live. In the image and the likeness of the fragmentation of a society that we have. All of this, if we stop and think about it, is like a frantic flailing around in the universe, searching for some kind of fulfillment and some kind of meaning. Those who love the Lord the God with their whole heart, with their whole soul, with their whole mind, know what meaning is. They know how to access it. They know how to live within it in the dynamic that it provides to the inner life of the person who seeks the Lord. In these things, then, Jesus' commandment has a very powerful impact on us in the modern world. It has a dramatic impact on the societies in the modern world. And the church must be very careful to nurture the first commandment if it is to preach the second. For without nurturing the first, it falls victim to the Marxist horizontal ideology of our age. And it allows itself, instead of being that institution which grants dimensionality and expansiveness of heart to the world, to become simply just another NGO, just simply another non-governmental organization which pursues all the same interests that somehow or other the political world, the flat political world of modern society does. And this is not to say that there is no good that comes out of government. Certainly that's wrong. And no good that comes out of a charitable institution. Certainly that's wrong. But the answer is, where does it go and why does it go there? What is it for and why is it there? You know, that when in fact it doesn't draw out, it doesn't draw out from the inside of persons their openness to the other, then simply somehow or other it does not serve their greatest need. The greatest need of the man robbed along the highway, he obviously needed attention, care, and medical service, but he did not, he also only received it because someone was capable of love. Someone was capable not of altruistic do-goodism, but someone was capable of loving another person because somehow or other, deep down inside of themselves, there was some kind of communication, some kind of sense of the presence of the living God. Let us in our lives also come to understand this need to fulfill the first commandment in order that we might fulfill the second one properly, that we might do so in a way that augments the value of the human person and does not denigrate it, does not turn it in, does not, we say, does not objectify it, does not turn it into somehow or other a project, that it is, in fact, an interpersonal reality in which those who love God automatically have an abundance of love for others and follow that love into the hearts and the lives of other peoples. This is the mission of the church, but it cannot accomplish its mission if it does not nurture and proclaim the first of the great commandments. And let us pray that in our community lives as Catholics, we may do this. We may help each other to nurture the reality of the first commandment, that we might effectively and in true charity and kindness and care implement the second commandment in our daily lives, in our place, in our world.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni, Sancte.